Hello and welcome to Choose a Fi. Today on the show, we have Nick Majuli, creator of the Dollars and Data blog and the chief operating officer for Ritholtz Wealth Management. And actually, he is the author of the new book, Just Keep Buying, Proven Ways to Save Money and Build Your Wealth. I think what's so interesting about Nick is how he dives into really the use of data to help grow your wealth, and also just has really interesting and kind of counterintuitive ideas, especially for those of us in the FI community at first glance. But I think once you dive into it, you realize, wow, this is perfectly in line. For those reasons, I think you're really going to get a lot of value out of this episode. So stay tuned. Welcome to Choose FI.
You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
All right. So actually, we have a special treat here. So I am bringing in a great friend of the podcast, Brian Feraldi, to help me interview Nick. Brian, as everybody here knows, is the author of the book, Why Does the Stock Market Go Up? And you can find that always at choosefi.com/Brian. So Brian, thanks for being here, buddy. I appreciate it.
Brett, it is awesome to be here. I am thrilled to have Nick on the show with you. I absolutely love, love, love his book, Just Keep Buying. I've been following Nick online for a few years. And as you teed up, one of my favorite things about Nick is he does not accept the status quo and the standard language that is thrown out there. He rejects all advice and he looks at the data. And I think some of the conclusions that he comes up with are counterintuitive to what I would have assumed. But since he backs up his assertions with data, I think there's a lot to learn from talking to Nick and reading his book.
Yep, wholeheartedly agreed. And with that, Nick, welcome to Choose a Fi.
Thanks, Brad. Thanks, Brian. Happy to be on the show.
Yeah, this should be fun. So let's start just very simply with the title of the book. So Just Keep Buying. You know, it's funny, you look at a title and you have that quick hit thought. And even though I'm steeped in personal finance, I looked at it and I'm like, just keep buying what? Like cars and boats and things? And then, you know, obviously I very quickly realized we're talking about just keep buying assets, right? And income producing assets is probably what your contention would be. But you said this was the mantra that changed your life. I'd love to really dive into that because I think this is critical for people and it's not that easy as well.
Yeah. So at the time, I was watching this YouTube video from Casey Neistat, and he had this video called Three Words that made me like got me a million subs or something. And he said that another YouTuber named Roman Atwood said, just keep uploading. And those were the three words. So every day he would be uploading these vlogs when he was in New York. And Neistat grew a huge YouTube following. And so at the same time that I was watching this by chance in early 2017 when I started blogging, I also was doing some analysis on the US stock market. And I realized that, you know, no matter when you purchased over a very long time period, if you just kept buying over time, you would have made money. Like there was no period, at least in the data, where you lost money over a very long period of time. So I think that was interesting. And this is especially true if you're buying over time, not just snapshots, where like a lot of investment analysis is just like, oh, you put money in now and then you wait 20 years. But no one invests like that. It's very rare you're going to invest like that. People are buying over time. And so I've done a lot of analysis to show that like if you just keep buying, you're very likely going to build wealth over the long run, right? And this is true, especially if you have a diversified portfolio amongst a bunch of other things. So yeah, the mantra is technically the continual purchase of a diverse set of income producing assets. That is the definition of just keep buying.
Nice. No, I like it. And I think so many people get bogged down in, you know, some of these like the great debates, right? Like, can you time the market? Is it dollar cost average versus lump sum? And I'd love to hear your thoughts on that, because I think there might be a math answer versus a behavioral answer, or they might just very well be the same. I'd love to hear, like, when somebody comes to you and says, hey, Nick, I just got X, I got a big bonus, and I'm thinking about investing it. What's my best strategy? I know, of course, it's hard to give financial advice, you know, one off, but how do you think through that rationally?
Yeah. So in that case, when you're thinking about whether you want to put all the money to work now or over time, I think we use certain terms and we need to be very careful when we say dollar cost averaging specifically, because there's technically two different definitions for dollar cost averaging and they mean opposite things. The original definition, which comes from Benjamin Graham, was, you know, buying over time, right? So every time you get paid a paycheck, you put some money into your 401k, right? You're investing as soon as you get the money. That's the original definition of dollar cost averaging. And that's the definition I use in the book. However, since then, people have said, okay, let's say you got a big bonus, like in the example you gave, Brad, and you can put it all in now, which is called a lump sum, or you can slowly put it into the market. I call this averaging in, but other people have called that dollar cost averaging. So you can see that these are different definitions, right? If you're buying immediately when you get your funds, that's dollar cost averaging. But then if you're waiting to slowly wade into the market, that's also called dollar cost averaging. But they're obviously very different. So in this case, how do I approach that problem? I say, let's look throughout history. Let's say you had a lump sum versus a, you know, you were going to either put the money in now or you were going to average in, let's say, over the next 12 months, 24 months, et cetera. What would have happened? What's the average result you would get? And most of the time you find, at least with US stocks, by putting the money in now, you tend to earn about 4 to 5% more than if you had slowly waited in. So mathematically, that's like, you know, the most likely outcome, and you would outperform in about 80% of periods, right? And this is not just true in US stocks. I did this, I have a whole table in the book where I do this with gold, I do this with Bitcoin, I do this with foreign stocks, I do this with basically every asset class, and the sooner you put it in, generally the better, right? So that's the math part. Now on the behavioral side, the only time that this average in method, this slowly wading into the market, wins out is when the market's crashing, right? So imagine it's, you know, February 2020, and I say, hey, you just got this lump sum, you should put it into the market now. And you say, you know what, I'm going to slowly kind of put the money in. Well, March 2020 comes along, right? It's the market's crashing very quickly. And then you're like, oh gosh, the question is, behaviorally, the only time it outperforms is when the market's crashing. You're very likely to not want to invest at that same time, right? It's very interesting because, like, the only time when the other method works, the suboptimal method, is when you're the most fearful to use it. So I think even behaviorally, it's tough to do, right? Like, imagine trying to, you know, the market just started crashing, the world shutting down, everything. Imagine, let's kind of go back to March 2020. Everyone listening to this lived through that. So let's go back to that and say, okay, would you have been able to just start putting money in at the time, you know? And I think a lot of people, it's tough. It's tough to do that when you see everything kind of shutting down and you start to get scared. So that's why I say, like, just put it in now, because the only time when you're going to be able to actually outperform is during the scariest time when you're least likely to want to do it, right? So that's kind of my take on it, you know? And I think it's funny that the math and the behavior kind of work together in that particular circumstance.
Nick, I want to ask you about something you said before, which is the motto of the book, Just Keep Buying, really applies to income producing assets. To me, just keep buying means continually adding small amounts of money over long periods of time. That's easiest to do in today's economy with the stock market and the bond market. Are there any other asset classes that you would add to that?
Yeah, I mean, you can do it. So when you say the stock market, obviously most people think of US stocks, but you can do it with foreign stocks. Obviously, that includes emerging markets, developed markets, etc. You can do it in real estate investment trusts, which is an easy way, easy way to get exposure to real estate, which I'm assuming most of the audience has at least heard of in some way. So instead of buying a property, which usually requires a lot of upfront cash, it's now going to be a very large portion of your portfolio. You can have a very small slice. So for example, if you had, let's say, $100,000 to invest, it's very difficult to buy a property that's only worth $10,000, right? Most properties are worth a lot more than that. However, it's very easy to put $10,000 into a REIT, right? So you could have a 10% sleeve without having all the underlying baggage of an entire real estate property to manage. In addition to that, there's a lot of other things you can do. There's farmland, which that's usually done more with private stuff. You usually have to be a accredited investor. So that requires slightly higher, you know, net worth thresholds or income thresholds to get there. There's things like royalties. And there's even like your own products. And so I know, like, I'm not trying to just move this all into side hustle stuff, but like there is something to be said about kind of creating your own products and doing things that actually kind of earn you income over time. So there's a lot of different ways to do it. I think property is a big one. But as I said, there's like limits to this. The simplest way when you have less money is stocks, bonds, and probably REITs, if I had to start there, right? And there's some farmland REITs as well. So those are probably the starter ones. But as you start to acquire more wealth, you can start getting into other asset classes, which require larger initial investments.
So definition of income producing assets here, I guess I'd love to hear your thoughts on that in regard to stocks. I think when most people hear income producing, they think immediately dividends, but I don't know if that's what you're necessarily implying or if there's a larger extent to it. So talk us through that.
Yeah, so it doesn't have to, if a stock doesn't pay a dividend, that doesn't necessarily mean it's not income producing. For example, I mean, Amazon, at least, you know, most of its life has basically just taken its earnings and retained them and reinvested them in the business. So it's never paid a dividend. However, you know, the stock price has gone up based on the future promise of future cash flows, et cetera. So it doesn't necessarily need to pay a dividend to be income producing as long as the business is, you know, in theory growing and, you know, using its capital efficiently, it is, I would consider, an income producing asset. Now, of course, someone would say, well, what about a small private company that's not profitable yet? Is that an income producing asset? Not yet, but it could be. It's a tough, those are kind of tough things. So for example, I consider my private investments in small companies, I have three of them, they're very small, to all be non-income producing assets, though they could be income producing assets, right? And so I think, you know, when you're doing like S&P 500, that's like definitely income producing assets. But when you're talking small, private, very risky things where you're getting in a Series A or something or later, I think I would consider those non-income producing. So yeah, for the most part, the income does not necessarily need to be given to you for it to be an income producing asset. As long as it's being given to someone in the business or in the structure that it's being, you know, reinvested to increase future earnings, that's all that kind of matters.
Nick, when I think about the macro landscape today, there's no doubt that historically looking back, just keep buying has worked. However, there have been periods in U.S. history over the last 100 years where it worked better than other periods. That's just the nature of the markets. When I look now, there's definitely a ton of macro things that are going on. We have a war, we have supply chain challenges, we have rising inflation, we have political strife, etc. Is there anything that would change your mind about just deploying a pure just keep buying strategy at the macro level?
Probably only like the apocalypse. I think like a nuclear war. I know you're laughing, but like that's probably the only real thing where I'd be like, okay, I don't think it, but then at that point, it doesn't really matter. I think at some point, like, yes, we're going to go through bad periods. I mean, for example, right now, this could be start of a decade where US stocks go nowhere. It's very possible, right? And this has happened before. This happened 2000 to 2010. Basically, US stocks went nowhere for a decade because 2000 prices were so elevated. Some would say maybe 2021 was a similar kind of corollary there. So we could be doing that. However, that's if you look at a snapshot. If you look at someone who is actually adding over time, it's not as bad. So that's another thing to keep in mind. There are other scenarios where, like, I've studied markets, for example, I think Spain, 1973 to 1983. And I mean, most people don't know the Spanish stock market history, but that was probably one of the worst periods. That thing was literally down for 6 years, started to go up a little for half a year, and then went down for another 4 years. So unless you're in an environment like that, the US has not had something like that. Going sideways sucks, but if you're adding money over time, it's okay. As long as we just don't see a slow, prolonged downturn, which has never happened in the history of the US stock market, then I don't have much to worry about. And in the event we do see something like that, we probably have bigger problems in our investment portfolio, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, that makes sense. And it ties into kind of like my zombie apocalypse type. And that's why I was chuckling when you said apocalypse. But obviously, you're talking about like a real world thing. But the zombie apocalypse, right? People are constantly, oh, inflation hedge. I'm going to have gold and I'm going to bury it behind my house. But when you actually game out a scenario where the world comes to an end, in essence, are you really going to, what are those gold bars going to be worth? And I've heard you talk about this. I think it was on Infinite Loops, where, you know, in essence, what you're actually going to need is food, ammunition, antibiotics, things like that. It's kind of a bizarre sidebar, but like, it ties into what you were saying before about the behavioral, right? It's like when you actually game out the scenario, this is not helping you the way you think it's helping you, in essence.
Yeah, exactly. And I think for me, I've become much more optimistic on how resilient people are just and societies are, because like I was in New York City when COVID hit, right? So I was like, this was like the world stage. I remember one point I went out very early in the morning. I haven't told the story to anyone, at least not on a podcast. Went to Times Square. There was nobody there. It was literally, I don't know if we will ever the rest of our lives see Times Square that empty, except, you know, unless they close it off for an event or something, right? You will never just be able to walk in there and see nothing, right? And it was like something out of an apocalypse. And I was like, not going to lie, it was a little scary, but there were moments in there where once we came out of that, especially how the market came out of that and everything, like I was like, you know, when the whole world's shutting down, if that doesn't bring us to our knees, you know, in civilization, then what will, right? It has to be something far more extreme than that.
Hey, I wanted to really quickly go back to REITs, so real estate investment trusts. I feel like this is something that is under-discussed in the financial independence community. So we talk about investing in single-family rentals and the like and thinking about it as a business, but for a lot of people, it doesn't pass the sleep well at night test, frankly, right? Like, hey, if I have one property and it's not rented, my income is zero, this is a zero return. It just, there's a lot of perceived risk. And when I run the numbers, the upside is not all that significant. It's like a 6% return plus maybe some minor appreciation. And, you know, plus or minus, it depends where you're talking about, right? But talk us through REITs really quickly. Because again, this is something that, like, how would you compare that to owning a single family rental or two for somebody who's looking to get real estate exposure?
Okay, I'll do this very simply using an example with stocks. Imagine I told you, okay, you want to buy a $500,000 property and you put 20% down, let's say $100,000, right? And I know most of the US single family homes could be cheaper than that, but I'm just trying to make the math easy, right? What if I told you that you had to put $500,000 into Apple? You have your S&P 500, all that. I said, nope, you have to put all that into Apple. How would you feel right now? Or just not even Apple, just any single stock. How would you feel? What a REIT is to real estate is what the S&P 500 is to Apple. It's diversification, right? And of course, you're not going to be perfectly diversified. You might not get every market. You might not get every residential or commercial market, but you're going to get far more diversification. And that's really what allows me to sleep at night. You're right. Because if you have one property and it's not selling, or something happens in the area, or you have to deal with a particular idiosyncratic issue or an issue that's very specific to that property, that can drive you crazy. And so with a REIT, some of those properties are going to have those issues, but a lot of them won't. And so because of that, you're diversified. So when I think about buying a property as an investment, it's the same thing as when I think about, like, would I put $300,000 or $400,000 into one stock, right? And if the answer is yes, that's, if you're comfortable doing that, that's fine. But that's kind of what you're doing. Of course, a stock is far more volatile than a home is usually, but that's kind of the similar type of thinking in terms of the size of the investment into one property versus diversifying across many properties. And I do think you can probably earn more in individual properties, especially because you have to manage it yourself. You're not paying a management fee. So there's that. And then you can get a little bit more leverage than you can with the REIT. So there are some benefits there that in terms of return. But the question is, you know, someone, I can't remember who came up with this term, but I've heard the term return on hassle. Is that worth your time and effort and the headache and all that? And that's what you have to really think about. So for me, I try to reduce hassle because I don't think that extra, whatever, 2-3% a year, whatever it is, whatever I'm going to get from managing my own property is worth the headache of getting that return. At least not yet. Maybe if I had $10 million, that 3% would be worth it. But with my current net worth, it's just not there.
Nick, as I teed up at the top of the show, one of my favorite things about you is you put forward ideas that I think are counterintuitive to what I would naturally assume, and then you back them up with data. The people in the Choose FI community tend to be optimizers, and they tend to be hyper-focused on savings rates, reducing expenses. One of the things that took me by surprise in your book is that you believe strongly in the concept that you can save too much. Can you double click on that for the community?
Yeah. So the reason I came up with this conclusion is that I was looking at some of the data on bequests that people leave behind, you know, after they pass away. And you see generally a pattern of as people are older, they're leaving more money to their heirs. And so the amounts that they leave is generally larger. And I think the best example that kind of illustrates this, Michael Kitsis did an analysis where he said, okay, if you had $1 million, it doesn't matter how much you have invested. I'm just going to use $1 million to make the numbers easy. Just so imagine you have $1 million nest egg, 60-40 portfolio, right? And you're using the 4% rule. You're pulling 4% a year. You're actually pulling down principal, et cetera, right? And you're doing that over the next 30 years. The probability that you triple your net worth is just as high as the probability of you having less than your $1 million after 30 years. It's kind of crazy. I'm sorry, not triple, quadruple your net worth. I apologize. If you start with $1 million after 30 years, you're just as likely to have 4X as to have under $1 million, right? So most of the time you're going to be in between that because the market growth has, you know, been, you know, not super high, but like it goes to show like most people's wealth keeps going up over time. I mean, you look at some of the data on how much money people are actually pulling out, you know, only 1 in 7 retirees with a portfolio is actually pulling down principal. The other 6 out of 7 are living off the dividends, and most of them are living off less than the dividends and reinvesting, right? I mean, look at RMDs, which are, I'm guessing your audience knows, required minimum distributions, which is basically the government says you have to take money out to pay taxes. Most of those RMDs are ended up reinvested in the market. These people just don't know what to spend it on. So, I mean, that's at least the historical data. Maybe today's cohort of people is different. That's possible. That's one possibility. I don't really believe that too much. However, I'm just saying the data looks pretty clear that like people are not running out of money and all this type of stuff isn't happening in mass. If anything, most retirees and people, especially people who are listening to this podcast, are probably very financially responsible. They probably have enough. These are the people that have the least to worry about. It's the people that have not saved anything, right? You have to also remember, like for most people, the average, you know, benefit paid for Social Security. So these are people in the US, you're going to be getting $1,500 a month, right? 18 grand a year. So you have to really say, what's my income above that 1,500? So if you're already living this super low cost lifestyle, like, you know, if you own your own home and you give them $1,500 a month already, like you could have like zero retirement savings and like you would be okay. It wouldn't be great, I admit, but like a lot of the people on here are saving money. So they're going to have income. They're going to have assets they can pull from. So I think when you look at it, most people end up realizing like, oh, wow, I saved way more than I needed. Of course, maybe they want to bequest, you know, give a lot of that away after they pass. That's fine. But I just think the data on that is pretty clear that people are, a lot of people, not everyone, there's a lot of people who are struggling, but there's still a good portion of people that I would say are probably oversaving.
Let me say that again, because that stat blew me away. 6 out of every 7 retirees are not drawing down the principal. So is the likely conclusion from that, that rather than pulling down their principal, they're just simply adjusting their spending to whatever they have?
Yeah. So basically what people do is they, what I call, you know, income matching. So let's go back to the example. You have $1,500 a month from Social Security. Let's say you actually have a spouse as well. So you have $3,000 a month. And let's say your investments earn you another $1,000 a month. So what people do, that means you have $4,000 income. They just spend that $4,000. Even though they could be pulling down from their portfolio and drawing assets and maybe bringing another $2,000-$3,000 a month to using the 4% rule, they don't do it. They just match their spending to their income. It's a very simple balance. That's how most people do it. I'm not saying everyone does it, but if you look at the vast majority, that's what happens. And by the way, that 6 out of 7 stat, that's for people that have a portfolio. There's like some 30, I think it's 30-something percent of Americans don't have any assets at all when they get to retirement. So those people, they aren't pulling money out because they don't have any money to pull out. But of the people that even have a portfolio, only 6 out of 7 are doing it. And that's the point. Most people listening to this have a portfolio. They're in that subset. So that's what matters.
Yeah, I like that example of the, you know, starting with the million, you're equally as likely to have 4 million versus under a million in essence.
And after 30 years, yeah.
Which, right, is remarkable. So it's important that people hear that because I think a lot of people still have that scarcity mindset, right? We're actually worried about exhausting the money, Nick, not just being under the million, but literally exhausting the money. So, I mean, you didn't even bring that up as, you know, of course it's a potential, but it's like a tail end possibility based on what you're looking at here. But I think also a lot of people, especially in our community, are ultra conservative when it comes to things specifically like Social Security. So we're not, when we're running our numbers, we're not even accounting for that. And you're saying that's going to be potentially $18,000 a year, right? $1,500 a month. That, again, we're being ultra conservative and not even considering that. So I'm curious, like, I think a lot of people like to debate the minutiae, right? So the 4% rule, which we call the 4% rule of thumb, is it the 3.25? Is it the 3.5 or the 4? Like, you're looking at this and saying, okay, 4%. There's a real high likelihood of success. I'd love to hear your, as you've jumped into these numbers, like how do you really think through that 4% rule, I guess, for you personally?
I think there's a lot of different ways to look at this. I mean, in terms of the 4% rule, it's funny right now, like the 60-40 is having the worst year it's basically had, I think, maybe on record or going back to, I don't know, maybe the Great Depression. I don't know, because the bonds are doing so badly, basically. But in terms of when I think about like the 4% rule and like, you know, we have no idea what the future is going to hold. And so maybe that's not going to be true anymore. Maybe the stat I just gave about Kitsies won't be true anymore. But there's a lot of things that probably will still likely to be true. So maybe it's not, okay, you're as likely to 4X your wealth as go under, you know, 1X. Maybe it's you're as likely to 2X your wealth. And so maybe the returns are lower than we expected, lower than history, because we could come up with a lot of reasons why returns are going to be lower going forward. Let's say that's true. Even if that's true, like, the point is you're still probably going to be fine, right? I think that's the thing. At the end of the day, it's like, what are we really doing here, right? Because there's so many different factors. Most people are going to just income match. So if you're just income matching, it doesn't matter like how much you save, because you're just going to, if the data shows most people income match, it doesn't matter how much you save, only up to the point, because you're going to match your income regardless. So if you're like, oh, I could have saved an extra $1 million to get an extra, you know, whatever, 30 grand a year, whatever that would have produced in income. But like, you see what I'm getting at? It's very interesting because like, no matter what you do, people income match. So like, you can save a lot more and then you'll just have more income and you'll just have more spending in retirement. If you don't save as much, if you don't make it there, then guess what? You'll make it work. Like, people do that. So it's like, we're very flexible. I think people are very flexible. Society is very flexible. And that's kind of the takeaway I get from the data. It's that like, yes, you can sit and worry about this, but like running out of money is like not the thing I see. I don't see that happening that often. And so that fear is basically non-existent for most people. Remember, I still think Social Security is going to be there. I mean, maybe it's not going to be, you know, inflation adjusted in dollars, $1,500 now, maybe it's only gonna be $1,000. Even if we run out of money, the people paying into the system will be able to pay benefits to like 2070 or something, but it's gonna be like a reduced benefits. I talk about this in the book, you know, it's like 75% of benefits will be paid. So people are still gonna get paid. It just might be less than what we expect. So don't plan for zero, maybe plan for like $1,000 a month. I mean, it's not a ton of money, but hey, it helps. It's better than zero, right?
Nick, I love that. I love that one of the big points that you're making is there is such thing as saving too much. If you look at the actual data, people tend to adjust their spending to their income. That makes total sense to me. And what Brad said before really rings true, how people in the FI community, myself included, tend to think worst case scenario, tend to build in layer and layer upon layer upon layer of safety net as if we're really scared of what could happen down the road. So that data is super helpful.
I listen to a lot of podcasts. The Tim Ferriss Show has always been my favorite by far, but for the first time ever, there's a real rival for that top spot. It's a show called My First Million. When I see a new episode show up in my podcast player, it's a drop everything and listen kind of situation for me. The show is all about business building and growth hacking, from how to make $1,000 in a weekend type side hustles to billion-dollar ideas and everything in between. The show is fun, it's infectious. The hosts, Sam Parr and Sean Perry, have an amazing rapport. In fact, if you're a longtime Choose a Vibe fan, I think you'll find it's the closest thing to me and Jonathan you've ever heard. And Sam and Sean are legit. They've built and sold eight-figure businesses to HubSpot and Amazon, and they have an amazing network of friends and colleagues they get on the show to share their wisdom. If I lost everything and had to start over from scratch, I can honestly say the first place I'd start is with My First Million. I think the mindset of business building they cultivate is unmatched, so I'd seriously just listen to every episode in their feed and go from there. The show is a little bit of an acquired taste, but as you get to know Sam and Sean, you'll see just how brilliant they are. So take my word for it and listen to at least a handful of episodes. I think you'll love it. So search for My First Million, that's My First Million, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
So one of the things that you've written about recently on your blog is really about how to spend more optimally. So if you could share any rules of thumb that you have about how people can get comfortable with spending more freely while they're in the building wealth mode, that would be fantastic.
Yeah. So I looked at some data on like the biggest financial regrets people have. And basically they come down to two things. One is like too much credit card debt, you know, using credit cards too much. I'm guessing most people listening to this podcast don't have that issue. I mean, if you're being financially responsible, trying to go to FI, you're probably not relying on credit cards all that much. The other two big regrets are not having an emergency fund and not saving for retirement, not starting sooner, saving, et cetera. So once you get past that, like I don't see many people saying, oh, I wish I hadn't gone out and, you know, had a nice dinner, or I wish I hadn't done this, or I wish I hadn't bought, you know, those type of regrets don't really show up. Most of the financial regrets are kind of missing the big thing. So once you get those big things in place, all the rest is details. And we're kind of just like picking at each other. And it's the minutiae, as Brad said, like we're just kind of really trying to cut into what's the exact most optimal way to do this. And for most people, it doesn't really matter. I think we spend way too much time thinking about that, right? And so in terms of like spending rules I come up with, if you still are having problems spending money, I have a couple different ways you can do this. In the book, I talk about something called the 2X rule, which is basically, oh, you want to go and splurge and buy yourself, let's say, a $400 pair of dress shoes. Well, save up another $400 and put it into income producing assets, invest it, right? So you have to save $800, 2X of the purchase price, right? That's one way to do it. Another thing I say to focus on is focus on your fulfillment. Don't just look at happiness. Happiness can be fleeting at times. What's really fulfilling? So for example, if you want to run a marathon, like spending extra to get like the best gear to run in, or to get, you know, tracking software or whatever you need to do, even pay a personal trainer, that can be worth it because it could be something very fulfilling for you and something that really adds a lot of value to your life. Even though you're spending a lot of money in an area that most people don't spend money on, it can be worth it to do that. It's just about thinking about like your values and things like that. So that's the second way. The third way, which is something I didn't really talk about in the book, but something I've read since, there's a great book called Die with Zero by Bill Perkins. And he talks about this thing called memory dividends. So when you create memories, you can think about that memory. And so that keeps paying you in terms of happiness or fulfillment like years into the future. So spending a lot on a nice vacation, it's like, oh, we did this really cool thing. And that's a memory we're going to have for many years to come. And so the question is like, the more memory dividends you build, it's going to be paying you this little dividend of thought every time you think about that memory into the future. So that's something to think about. And I think that's the point of money, is to like spend it so that we can enjoy our lives, right? And so don't get me wrong, I'm all about saving and saving money and being responsible. I would be the first person to tell you that. But once you kind of get those big pillars in place and you're kind of moving in the right direction, like ease off the gas a little bit, just relax and kind of enjoy your life, right? That's kind of where I'm getting to. I'm trying to get more balance into the personal finance community. I've seen way too many people of like, oh, I have to have an 80% savings rate, 50%, 60%. It's like, just like relax. You're probably going to be fine. Just enjoy your life. Don't, you shouldn't have anxiety every time you go to pay for something, right? And there's other tools we can use. I can get into this more, but that's a much bigger conversation. But I'm just trying to bring some balance to the personal finance game.
Yeah, it's so important. And I think that's something we've really focused on here. And we've seen an evolution, frankly, just in our own mindsets and of the FI community generally. At the beginning, it was the let's race to this number, right? And that's the be all end all. When you hit the number, life is great. But I think we all know that's not the way the world works. If you are focusing on that as this panacea that life is going to be wonderful and you've missed those years along the way, or if you haven't actually focused on, hey, what lights me up? What do I enjoy out of life? Like, you're going to wake up once that number hits X on the screen, and it's going to be pretty lacking because I don't know what you're going to do with your life at that point, right? So I think that's something. And interestingly, Nick, I was going to bring up Die With Zero. I think that book has had a large impact on my life significantly. So, you know, for me, it was like maybe a long blog post. It is, you know, maybe how I would have liked to see that book personally. But the point there is just so critical. It's like, it's rethinking your spending patterns. And I think it ties in perfectly with Wait But Why's article, The Tail End, which especially for me, I have two daughters who are 14 and 11 at this point. I know my time with them is fleeting. And that memory dividend is really critical. And would I rather spend money now when I can go on trips with them, when I can have experience with them, or would I rather spend it when I'm 80 and we're talking about assisted living or some other nonsense? Like, it's such a no-brainer when you think about it, but that rethink is really critically important. I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah, of course. Another thing that I've thought about, I mean, this is kind of a more controversial take I have, which is, I just wanted to bring this up because it kind of reminded me of the whole Die With Zero thing and like living longer, thinking about money and retirement. Someone asked me, you know, how do I catch up financially if I haven't been saving as much early in life? How do I catch up, right? And so people say, oh, you got to increase your returns or you work longer, things like that. And I have a very non-financial take to actually answer this. And it's, you should exercise more. And the whole idea is like, you should lengthen your life such that you can work more and be in good health, you know, later, so you can catch up. Basically, that's the only way to get more time, right? Because we all assume our time is fixed. Like, we're gonna hit 65 and then we're just all going to retire. But that's not true. A lot of people, for example, I know I'm going to work past 65 if I can, assuming my health holds up. I think it will, right? I exercise a lot. But, you know, a lot of people just assume, oh, our time is fixed. We only have 40 years to invest from, you know, what, 25 to 65. But that's not necessarily true. You can add more time if you can just stay healthy longer. So if you're someone who hasn't, you know, been great at saving previously, like, I think it's a great idea. And it's very counterintuitive. You're saying, what do you mean exercise? Well, if you actually look at the data, you know, people who exercise, you know, regularly, I run the math, and basically every hour you exercise, if you do it consistently over time, you get about 6 to 8 hours of additional life late in life. Of course, that doesn't scale forever. You can't be like, well, I'm just going to exercise 4 hours a day and I'll live forever. You know, it doesn't work like that. But if you're just doing that and you're just doing that over time, you're going to add some life to the end, especially health span, like good, healthy living years, not just extra life that you're just sitting in a hospital bed or something or in hospice. It's, you're actually giving yourself some more actual life. And I think that's something that can be really interesting. And it also has financial benefits, like in terms of you can work more, you can save more, you can earn more by doing that over time. So I think it's something else to consider. And I'm just trying to promote this idea now. I just kind of wanted this out there because it's very counterintuitive. I think it's kind of cool. And I'm also trying to get people healthier. I think it's a net positive for everyone.
Yeah, Nick, I love that. I think you're a fan of Peter Attia, Dr.
Yeah,
Peter Attia.
Huge fan.
I am a massive fan. And yeah, I hear health span, longevity. It's so critical that we focus on that. And yeah, I was kind of, it's funny because actually, as I was saying, assisted living in my 80s, I expect I'm following the centenarian Olympics of trying to be the healthiest 90 or 100 year old I could possibly be. So it's interesting when you focus on that longevity and how it impacts your life positively. Like, I literally am doing his zone 2 training that he's constantly talking about. And it's, I mean, all of these things, like, how can you be healthy, wealthy, and happy, right? And it's like, I think all three of us are numbers people at our hearts, or maybe in prior lives is how I conceptualize myself at this point. But I think the behavioral aspect of what we're talking about here is critical. I think focusing on what makes you happy on a day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month basis, like, this stuff is really, really important. And I think a lot of people think of personal finance just as numbers. I think that's the easy part. The hard part is figuring out, what is this all for? Why am I doing this? Why am I saving?
Love that, Brad.
Yeah, I mean, I have a phrase I use in the book: before you figure out what you're going to retire from, or figure out what you're going to retire to, right? That's the big quote there.
Yeah, it's critical.
Nick, one of the other things that I read in your book, and it really made me think, a core money belief, is related to your 401k. I, for years, or for decades now, have just been the automatic assumption or the automatic advice I give to people is max out your 401k, period, end of story. It's got tax advantages to it. You'll get a high return. It's just a no-brainer to always max out your 401k, end of story. You have some data that challenges that belief. Can you share that with us?
Yeah. So basically, if you look at, you know, what's the actual benefit of, you know, maxing a 401k, the benefit you get of the tax sheltering, this is after the, remember, there's two levels of taxation. There's your income tax, right? So that's whether you do a 401k or a Roth. That's one decision. But let's put that decision aside for now, because that's not what the 401k benefit is, all the growth in the underlying investments, right? It's all the capital gains tax you're avoiding. So at the current capital gains rate, if you run the simulation of someone who puts money into, let's say, a Roth 401k, so it's after the income tax piece, right? And you just compare that to like a taxable brokerage account of someone who doesn't really sell, they just buy over time. And you do that over 30 years, the annualized tax benefit is something like 0.7% a year of using the 401k. So there is a benefit there, right? However, that doesn't include any difference in fees. So, you know, the average, you know, 401k fee somewhere in the US is something like 40 to 50 bips. So I'm sorry, 0.4 to 0.5%, right? So a bip is, you know, 0.01%. So if the benefit is 0.7 and the fees in a 401k are 0.4 to 0.5, you do that math there and you're really only getting about 0.2 to 0.3% per year. And some people who have, like, let's say you have a fee of like 1% a year in your 401k, which some people do have, some plans have that, or the fund fees are higher. Let's say you can only buy funds that have, that expense ratios are higher than what you could get in a brokerage account, right? As a result, if that's higher than 0.7, then you've lost all the benefit. There's actually a negative tax benefit to holding this thing, right? So I'm not saying that you should never max your 401k, but I'm saying there's a lot of people that are doing it and it's just given as like gospel. Like, as I said, you know, 10 out of 10 personal finance experts would say to max your 401k. And I just want us to have a conversation to get people to actually really think about this and look into their specific plan and say, does this make sense for me? And for example, I kind of regret maxing my, you know, late 20s because I was maxing. I was like, oh, this is great. I'll max, max, max. But now I'm like, okay, I wish I had more money on the outside of my retirement account so I could pay a down payment on a house or something like that. So I think there's a lot more flexibility when it's in a brokerage account. And so I kind of have some regrets about putting in all that earlier. And I wish there had been people that just said, hey, think about it a little bit more, especially if you're someone who's like has high earnings and you're saving every single year. It's something where you can be like, hey, like maybe I don't need to max. Now, by the way, for the record, you always, always, always should go up to the employer match. If you have a match, always go to the match. Free money, there's no debate there. This is about every dollar above the match, right? That's the question. So yeah, that's my take on it. I just want to start a conversation on it. I want us to really kind of think about it more instead of blindly telling everyone max your 401k, because it's not, for a lot of people, I don't think it's the right option. I mean, if you look at the 401k fees and how they're distributed, like something like, I don't know, at least 30, 40% of plans have fees that are above that 0.7%, which means you're going to kind of like, these high fees are going to eat away at your tax benefit. So you don't want to do that. So that's my take. And that's it.
I love that. Again, it's putting the data out there to challenge a belief. Again, my previous assumption was just max your 401k, period, end of story. It's a no-brainer. But as you point out, not only could the advantages, the tax advantage of doing so, not be as strong as you would have believed, but you're also tying your money up for 30 or 40 years at the same time. So if we're going to commit to doing that, if we're going to commit to tying our money up for that long of time, it makes sense to look at the numbers in your situation and ask, is the benefit I'm getting from this worth tying my money up for that long?
Yeah, exactly. And now some people say, well, you can pull it out for certain purchases and this and that. And we're getting into minutia once again. That's not the point. The point is there's a lot of people maxing out there that aren't even thinking about that and are just doing it blindly. And I'm just trying to like bring some awareness to this issue.
Yeah, it's important. It's challenging doctrine, right? And it's also, in this case, you're talking about opportunity cost. In essence, what else could I do with that money? And for somebody, it's going to be very situational, right? You're talking about in your 20s. Okay, sure, it's great you're maxing your 401k, but if that's the extent of your savings and your checking account, savings, whatever, regular taxable brokerage accounts are negligible, that's going to put you potentially in a tight spot. Or if there are other investment opportunities, right? It's, again, it's opportunity cost. So I think that's really critical. But yeah, as you said, and I really wanted to double down on it, is the employer match is free money. Please, please, please invest up to the employer match. I think all three of us would say that's kind of a no-brainer, you know, unless in a bizarre outlying situation, but for essentially everyone, get your match. So I wanted to actually go. So we're talking about kind of 401ks and saving and such, and how, I guess, things specifically for the FI community. So one of my favorite areas in here that I'd never jumped into the numbers was, how much of your raise should you save? And I think this is very interesting, again, as it impacts the FI community, who are, in general terms, super savers, right? So you have your path to retirement, your years mapped out. I have X number of years, 17 years to get to FI. But okay, you get a raise. And if you're thinking, hey, my savings rate is 50% normally, I just have to save 50% of my raise. That actually does not appear to be the case according to this chart that you've mapped out. And it's funny, like when you dive into it, it makes more sense, but I'd love for you to really educate the audience on this.
Yeah. So I think the way to think about this is to think about someone who's been saving at a, let's say a 50% savings rate for, I don't know, I'm just going to come up with some number. Of course, nothing's this linear and easy, but let's say 10 years, you're saving at a 50% savings rate. Let's say you're making $100,000 a year. So after tax, so you're saving 50 grand a year, which means you're spending 50 grand a year, right? That's your spending. Okay. You do that for 10 years. Now you get this raise of, let's say, 10%. You're getting an extra 10,000 a year. When you go to save, if you're going to save an extra $5,000, what does that mean that happens to the other 5,000? That other 5,000 is being spent. So now your annual spending isn't 50,000, it's 55,000. And so assuming you want to keep your lifestyle the same over time, lifestyle maintenance, you save for the first 10 years as if you're spending 50 grand a year, but now you need to save it for now and into your retirement as if you're spending 55 grand a year. And so because in the past you weren't saving enough for this future consumption you just added on, you technically need to save more than 50% of that raise to make up for it. It's really, you have to think about the impact on spending, right? And so what they tell a lot of people is like, oh, save all of your raises. And that's fine. If you save all of your raise, you'll get to your FI number more quickly, right? Because if your spending is consistent, but your income goes up, obviously you're just saving all that, you're just going to get to that number quicker. But if you want to spend some of it, splurge a little, you can. It's a question of how much of that can you spend? And so in the book, I talk about how much this is. For people with lower savings rates, I say it's around 50%. It makes it easy. But as your savings rate goes up and up and up, you need to save more and more of your raises in order to not impact your spending too much, right? And the examples I give are kind of extreme, but they're really there to show you. I mean, to make this easier, imagine you're making $100,000 a year. Let's say you got 100% raise, right? So now let's say you're making $200,000 after tax a year. Let's say you saved half of it. Okay, so now your spending went from 50K a year originally before the raise, but now you just got another 100K raise. So that's another 50 grand. Let's say you save half of it, right? So now your spending is 100 grand a year. So your spending just doubled instantly. And it didn't just double now, it doubled now until you're retired and then into your retirement. So you can see as the more extreme this gets, you realize, oh my gosh, I wasn't saving enough in my past because of this future raise I got. So you have to save more than 50% to make up for that. I hope that makes sense. But the book tries to explain this.
Nick, one of your chapters that I absolutely loved is called Why You Will Never Feel Rich. A lot of the themes of the topics we've discussed so far really challenge our feelings about money. I think people in the FI community, and I am 100% guilty of this, tend to think worst case scenario, planning for absolutely everything possible to go wrong. And if you have that mindset, no matter how much wealth you kind of build up, it never seems like enough. Can you talk about why you think most people never feel rich, even if they are rich?
I think the issue is that no one's comparing themselves to like a fair benchmark. And you're always comparing yourself to like your social circle. And obviously, if you're getting more wealth, you're moving into like, say, a more wealthy neighborhood or more wealthy city or something, you're going to start comparing yourself to those people, right? And you're going to keep kind of leveling up in this financial way and just comparing yourself to those people around you. And the example I give is Lloyd Blankfein, who is the ex-CEO of Goldman Sachs in the book. And in an interview, remember, he's a billionaire. He's a literal billionaire. And in the interview, he says, oh, I'm not wealthy. I'm just like well-to-do or something. I'm not rich. I'm well-to-do. Or he's a billionaire. It's like, to us, it sounds crazy, right? How can he say this? But when your friends are, you know, David Geffen, Jeff Bezos, people with 10, 100x, et cetera, of his wealth, he doesn't feel that rich. When he walks into the room, he's one of the least wealthy people there because he's just well-connected and known, you know? And so I think this gets at a lot of what we think about with wealth. You know, the other example I give in the book is like, okay, do you know that if you had $100,000, you know, that would put you in the top 10% of wealth in the entire world, right? You're in the top 10%. Now, I would consider someone in the top 10% to be rich relatively, right? You're saying, well, Nick, that's not fair. You can't say $100,000 and compare me to some random person, you know, in the developing world, let's say a farmer in, you know, Africa or Bangladesh or wherever, pick a place, doesn't really matter. You can't compare me to them, right? That's what maybe some of the listeners on this podcast would say. Well, guess what? Lloyd Blankfein thinks that we can't compare us to him either. He's looking down at us and saying, you can't compare me to those people. Like, I'm in a different sector than them. Just like we're doing the same thing to them, right? Of course, like Lloyd Blankfein's, you know, logic is more, I mean, it's more outlandish, but it's the same argument. Fundamentally, we're cutting hairs. What is rich really, right? Are we doing this at the national level, state level, the local level? I mean, we can cut hairs all we want, but we're all making the same arguments. For you to say, oh, the top, you know, having $100,000 doesn't mean you're rich in America. It's like, well, yeah, in America, that might be true, but like in the world, that's rich. And so like, where do we draw the line? I think that's the debate. And so that's why I feel like people will never feel like they're rich. And so how do you kind of get over that? You have to kind of just realize, like, think about like where you could have been in life. It's really tough to do this. I don't think there's an easy way to do it, but just, okay, think about how well you have it relative to others or how well you could have had it. Like, you know, if you could run your life 1,000 times, where would you be in that distribution? Like, I personally think I'm in like the top 5% of my outcomes, given my background and everything, right? And so I think I'm very lucky in that sense, but maybe not everyone feels that way. And so that's kind of the way how I do it. I try to use absolute measures and think about things more holistically and realize like, I'm definitely rich, you know, like in most of the world, I'm considered a rich person, even though I'm not a millionaire by any standard degree. I'm not rich here in New York City, definitely not. But however, relative to the world, I would consider myself a rich citizen of the planet. And I don't say that to brag. I say that because that's the only way you're going to prevent yourself from always wanting more and more and more.
Yeah, I think humans are not absolute animals. We truly are relative animals. And that's why, yeah, this is really important. And I wonder, like, if there's another way, like, to anchor yourself in potentially multiple communities. Like, I'm thinking about, okay, I live in an upper middle class area of Richmond, Virginia. And by no means am I depriving myself, but if I anchored myself to my neighbor who just bought a Mercedes, I'm going to feel pretty terrible with my Honda Civic, right? But being part of the Chooseify local group here in Richmond gives me, again, more of that relative of looking at similar people. So I find that that helps on some level. I don't know. Again, we're talking just kind of little random asides, but like, again, Nick, the behavioral stuff is what's really critically important. And that's the hard part. So I think just sometimes anchoring yourself, like you're saying, okay, I'm looking at relative, not with my peers in New York City necessarily, but if I can broaden that on some level, it's going to make it much easier and maybe more palatable, which, you know, I kind of hate to put it that way, but it is important just to realize it extends beyond your little local minute area. So, and Nick, just kind of talking in summer here, I was curious, and we like to get people's own backgrounds and thoughts into things, and I appreciate how you've jumped into this so much, is you talked about, obviously, income-producing assets, right? And that's how you conceptualize an investing strategy. But I also heard you say that you personally have a hard time with real estate because of what you saw your parents go through in the great financial crisis in the mid-2000s. And I know I was scarred by that, certainly. And it's been difficult to get over. And I'm curious, like, is that something that you think you will ever invest in? We're not necessarily a real estate show by any means, but I'm curious, like, how you think about your own investing life and the intersection of your past, current, and future, and how you think about that, really.
Yeah, so I'll definitely, I think, own my own home at some point. I think the data on that is, you know, most people own their own home. And so, you know, regardless of income level, et cetera, most people end up trying to buy their own home. And so it's not a matter of if, but a matter of when the time is right. So I think that's the big thing for me. In terms of as investment properties, I probably won't. I don't want to, return on hassle is big for me. So I'm probably just going to focus on, you know, REITs and things like that. Just make it easy. I don't want to have all that exposure. So of course, you never know. It's hard to predict the future. That's another thing. It's like difficult. What if I end up marrying someone who really wants to own rental properties and they want to manage it? Okay, that's fine. I'll let them do that. Whatever. I'm not going to control them and say we can never do that, you know? So it really is, depends on your life and what kind of circumstances you're in. So yeah, that's how I think about it. And yeah.
Cool. Nick, I greatly appreciate you coming on the show. This has been a blast. We'd love to have you back at some point in the future if you're up for it. And yeah, I guess let everybody know, again, the book is Just Keep Buying, and we'll have a link to it in the show notes, certainly. But let everybody know where they can find you, get in touch if they're so interested.
Yeah, so you can find me on Twitter at $andData, lowercase, or Nick Majuli on Instagram. And then my blog is at dollarsanddata.com. So you can find the book on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and anywhere books are sold.
Awesome.
So appreciate your guys' time.
Yeah, thanks again, Nick. And Brian, thanks for being my first co-host here. I really, really appreciate it. Always good having you on the show. And let everybody know, of course, again, even though you've been on the show more than any guest we've ever had, but let people know where they can find you.
Yeah, such a joy to be here. I love talking to Nick, and it's awesome to see his book is tearing up the charts, which is just awesome. But you can connect with me on Twitter at Brian Feraldi.
Thank you for listening to today's show and for being part of the Choosify community. If you haven't already, the best ways to get involved are, first, subscribe to the podcast. So you're listening to this on a podcast player, just hit subscribe. And then subscribe to my weekly newsletter. I actually sit down every Monday and write this by hand, and I send it out Tuesday morning. So just head over to choosefi.com/subscribe. And it's really, really easy to get on the newsletter list right there. And I would greatly appreciate it. It's the best way to get in touch with me. You can actually just hit reply to any of those emails, and it comes directly to my inbox. So that's the way that I keep a pulse of the community and how we keep this the ultimate crowdsourced personal finance show. And finally, if you're looking to join an in real life community, we have ChooseFI local groups in 300 plus cities all around the world. So head to choosefi.com/local, and you'll find a list of all of those cities in 20 plus countries all across the world. And if you're just getting started with FI, or you have a family member or a friend who you think would be interested, two easy ways. ChooseFI episode 100 is kind of our welcome to the FI community. And even though it's a couple years old at this point, it still stands up. And it's a really great just starting point to get an understanding of what is financial independence? What are we doing here? Why are we looking to live a more intentional life where we save money and use it as a springboard to live a better life? And then ChooseFI created a Financial Independence 101 course that's entirely free. Just head to choosefi.com/FI101. And again, thanks for listening.